It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 74 for Friday, the 4th of May, 2012. On the show this week, the Xbox gets banned in Germany, not because of a violent game, but because of Motorola. An ambitious and wealthy Australian wants to develop Titanic 2, not a movie sequel, but a clone of the original liner. And if you're wondering why the Pirate Bay is no longer available in the UK, it's because the High Court has ruled ISPs must block it entirely. But has the plan backfired? All that and quite possibly more than ever before is coming up on today's jam-packed show. Ahoy, and of course, hoy, Nate Langson here, editor of Wired.co.uk. Duncan Gear in the house, news editor.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Really well.
Good to hear it. And also, of course, our associate editor, Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
Now, we've got a jam-packed day today. Normally, we have an item on our sheet that says banter, 60 seconds, and we talk about something spontaneously. But we've got too much to do to get into that.
When you say spontaneously, it is actually written in our lineup, yeah. So it's not that spontaneous.
And maybe this is all scripted. Who knows? Who knows? Anyway, Germany. A German court has banned the sale of the Xbox 360. Motorola won an injunction in the German court, which bans Microsoft from selling its console and also Windows 7 in the country. And by extension, this also means Microsoft is not allowed to offer Internet Explorer or Windows Media Player.
That's a bit unfair.
The bad news bears are having a picnic and everything's gone off. Yeah, it's all over a patent infringement lawsuit that Motorola has alleged Microsoft infringes on two of its patents.
And which patents are those then?
They relate to the H.264 video encoding.
Okay.
Which is kind of the technology that's used most on the web now for encoding video, high quality video.
And for playback, I guess, as well.
And for playback, yeah. And so because this is used in the Xbox, it's used in Windows, it's used in IE, and of course Windows Media Player, well, Motorola has a problem with that.
So you can't buy an Xbox in Germany now?
Well, that's the thing. The ban won't be imposed until a US court actually decides whether it is going to lift a restraining order that Motorola currently has placed on it by, drumroll, Microsoft, over a previous little spat.
So hang on. So a US court has jurisdiction over whether a German court can impose a restraining order?
But pretty much.
Yeah, that's mad.
It is mad, but you know, it's the stupid thing is, it's all over these patents and some kind of key patents that Motorola has, and Microsoft reckons that if it pays as much as Motorola wants, then it could cost them £2.5 billion a year. Motorola says it's less, but it's still more than Microsoft's paying at the moment.
But that's the thing: there are certain patents that you need to set standards across technology, different platforms, and it requires everyone to adopt them in order to set that sort of standard, including the kind of, you know, video standards. And I think that's what the kind of crux of the argument is people like Microsoft are saying, we need to use this patent in order to have the standards that we're setting to make their, you know, to make sure that we can grow in the way that we want to. And Motorola's just, you know, picking fights.
That's exactly right. They need them on fair and reasonable terms, and the patent owners that have these essential patents are kind of obliged to license them to anyone who wants to license them for a fair amount of money, and Motorola reckons Microsoft isn't paying enough.
Those are called FRAND commitments, for those who are writing notes down at home.
They are. There's a hearing scheduled next week about the restraining order, so we'll have to follow it. But Liv, a bloke has decided he wants to build a clone of the Titanic.
Yes, a guy, a very rich mining magnate in Australia called Clive Palmer, has already signed a deal with a Chinese shipyard to clone the Titanic. And yeah, he wants to make it sail from the UK to the US in 2016.
So he's cloning the entire Titanic?
Yeah, he's going to do an exact scale replica of the original Titanic, but with state-of-the-art technology and navigation and safety systems.
Okay, so it won't still run on coal?
No, he says it's going to run on diesel, and they've made slight changes to the bow to make it better for fuel efficiency. They made it more bulbous. I'm not quite sure how exactly.
Have they got better iceberg detection systems?
They say they've got better safety and technology systems. I presume that includes iceberg detection.
Now, let me just pull out my fork of skepticism again, stick it in this little potato. Why would anyone want to get on something called Titanic 2 and sail to the US on it? I mean, does that not spell disaster in no uncertain ways?
Well, it sort of ties back to something we were talking about in the previous podcast, this kind of like for tourism to gruesome places. And you can imagine there'll be a whole wave of tourists who'd be willing and you know, to part with lots of cash to kind of relive the Titanic experience. And you can
and
imagine
buy a t-shirt saying I survived the Titanic.
Yeah. But yes, yeah, so they've, I mean, they've kept all the original rooms, 840 rooms, and all the same decks, gym, swimming pool, libraries and restaurants. So yeah, I can imagine there'll be some reenactment going on.
I want to go on there and be painted like one of those French girls.
Like one of which French girls?
It's from the movie Liv.
Okay, I don't know Titanic that well.
One of my favourite things about this story was what Mr. Palmer said when asked if it could sink. He said, of course it's going to sink if you put a hole in it. It's going to be designed so that it won't sink. It will be designed as a modern ship with all the technology to ensure that it doesn't happen. But of course, if you're superstitious like you are, you never know what could happen.
You do never know. I mean, you know, they're not building future reading devices into these ships yet, are they, Duncan?
Well, maybe.
Who knows?
Modern technology.
Technology is the topic of our next story, actually. And, well, it's to do with church music. Interested me. Piqued my interests. Duncan?
It isn't really about technology at all.
Well, it's about an iPad app.
Yeah, that's
go
true.
Go on. How has church music and iPad apps come together this week?
Well, shall we give an audio demonstration?
Oh, yeah, we can. Okay, so what are we hearing here?
We're hearing the music of Force, which is the musician name for Eric Volforce, who's the CTO of SoundCloud in his normal life, but in his spare time, he puts out electronica music. And this is his latest project. It's called Ecclesia, and it's an iPad app album that mixes church music with electronica.
Interesting, and you spoke to him to find a bit more
about
this.
I did. I spoke to Eric. I asked him where he got the inspiration from the idea from.
I did my previous album 9 years ago, and already back then I sort of had a few ideas on, you know, how to create something more than just an album. One of my first memories is actually me sort of being in a church watching my mother conduct her choir. Ever since then, I would say that choir music and sort of spiritual music, church music, has had really sort of a profound effect on me. I mean, it's not all of that music, but there are some pieces and some works that really has this sort of deep effect that I can't really explain. One of the first sparks of the whole project, or sort of one of the main points, was when I tried to record something in a church and I listened to it afterwards in my headphones, and I realized that there's something there as well, sort of between the music. There is the room and the sort of just that feeling of being in that space.
I also spoke to the designer Leo Lass about the visual elements of the app, because when you play around with it on the screen, the music will also change in certain ways. He said this.
Basically, what we did is we were inspired by those formal and referential systems that the whole religious and liturgy part brings to us, what is basically the foundation of our culture, and we tried to modernize it as well. We used fragments of it and used it in a very new and modern context, the iPad and also generative graphics. But we also tried to, with the illustration, for instance, to use the same symbol language, the same ancient symbol language, which is not really known to us anymore, which leaves us with a kind of a vacuum of narratives.
It took about 9 years for him to get the project together from kind of start to finish. And I asked him how that process went.
I'm really happy to be able to sort of, after 9 years of having thought about these kinds of things, finally meeting up with these great people like Marcel and Leo to be able to pull something like this off. It's been a really fantastic journey. It's been a long time coming, and it's great that it's finally out there.
Sounds quite cool.
Yeah,
where do we hear it?
If you want to get hold of, well, you can hear it right now. It's playing in your ears. But if you want to get hold of it and play with the iPad app aspects of it, then you can go to forcemusic.com. And it will also, if you're not an iPad owner, you can also play some of the songs from it on that website as well. forcemusic.com.
Keeping it real, keeping it iPad. Okay, let's stay on the topic. I don't know what that meant, but let's stay on the topic of iPad. Because Spotify's landed on the iPad.
Finally.
You know what, Duncan? Honestly, when I heard this news, I saw your eyes. You know when you see like a rabbit in the headlights lit up, but with fear. It was like that, but with excitement. It was almost sexual.
It's big news.
Why?
It's big news because they've been promising it. They've been denying it. They've been saying, maybe we're going to do one for about 3 years now.
So what? You know, it's just renting music.
So what's the best features about it? Like, why is this such a big deal for you or for people who have iPads?
It's a big deal because it hasn't been available properly on the iPad before. And the iPad is a really interesting device in terms of how you use it. You kind of sit down on your sofa and you can explore. And Spotify's moving in very much of more of an exploration direction, particularly with its new apps on the desktop version of the app. It's all about discovering music and looking around and seeing what your friends are listening to. And the iPad app does all that stuff very well. It's got the social tools that are built into it let you very, very easily browse your friends' playlists, subscribe to them. You can kind of really spend your time immersed in music with it, and that's really cool.
And you still need a subscription, though.
You still need a £10 a month subscription to use it, a premium subscription, though they did announce today that NUS card holders can get, or what is it, NUS Advantage, I think, the upper tier of NUS cards, students will be able to get half that off, so they'll be paying a fiver a month.
So students who can afford a posh access to discounts can get cheaper access.
Sounds like they could, an iPad.
Yeah, they sound like they could probably afford it. But no, that's probably quite a game changer, particularly in tackling piracy, I guess.
I think so. But what I was really, not annoyed, that's a bit strong. I was disappointed that they didn't include those aforementioned apps. There's some amazing, amazing stuff that that you can do on the desktop version of Spotify through the app system, you know, like reading reviews from Pitchfork or something like that and listening to the music at the same time. That would be incredible on the iPad, and it isn't included.
Okay, so then just remind me, how is this actually different from the phone app then?
Well, it's kind of designed for a much bigger screen. It's optimized for the Retina display and all that, and it also has a really nifty function to kind of make it all full screen, so you get really big cover art, and so you can kind of just prop up your iPad on the side of the room, hook it up to your AirPlay speaker, and just have music playing out, and it looks and behaves really nicely.
But in terms of kind of functionality,
it's largely the same. I mean, it still just streams music, lets you explore your playlists, but it's a much nicer interface for doing that with.
Do you know what though? Going back to the apps story from before, like, we're seeing a real trend in kind of music apps coming out, and they all tend to come out on the iPad. Don't you think this would have been a really good opportunity for Spotify to say, hey, we're going to be a music app discovery tool as well?
Like, yeah, and very much that's what they're doing on their desktop version, and that's the real kind of game-changing part of what Spotify's doing right now. And that's why I'm kind of a little disappointed that they didn't bring those aspects to the iPad yet. I suspect it's something they're working on.
I see. So quite excited, but moderately disappointed. Would you say you are appointed?
I would say I was roughly appointed.
Fair enough. Let's move on to something a bit more science-based. Liv, a machine has been created that slices, scans, and 3D maps the human mind.
Yes.
Sort of.
It's actually been starting with mouse brains. But yes, it's a machine from the researchers at Texas A&M University. And what they've done, they've developed this machine that slices bits of brain into very, very thin, half micrometer thick sections using a diamond knife. And as it's slicing it, it lights it up with a laser and then then at the same time images it using a microscope.
But the really cool thing that got me about this is that you mentioned Google Maps in your story.
Yes, it then stitches together all these little sliced images together into a 3D model of the brain that it's been slicing up. And then you can go and explore it online just as you could explore a Google Map.
It's not to do with Google, though, is it?
It's powered by Google Maps.
Oh,
yes,
it is
the technology is, yeah.
Really? I didn't know that.
It
interesting.
Is.
In that case, I could take this thought one step further and imagine, in the same way you've got Google Maps, if you could, you know what, you can drag a little man into Google Maps and you can see kind of from a street level perspective, like Google Street View. Imagine if you could do that with memories.
Okay.
Google Memory View.
That would be pretty awesome. At the moment, it's just limited to neurons, which I think is still pretty awesome. It's got an amazing resolution, 300 nanometer resolution, and yes, you can go right down to the individual neuron of the brain.
And just to bring back, I guess, myself back to reality, what is the purpose of this specifically? I mean, it's research, but is there any goal?
It's research to help understand the structure of the brain, and the best thing is this is fairly affordable technology. There are other projects. Microsoft Paul Allen's been working on something like this, but it uses incredibly expensive tools, and this is a much cheaper way of doing it, so any lab could potentially build up these 3D images of brains that we're studying.
Wow. I would like to donate my brain for something like this. We've talked about brain donation in the past, actually.
We have.
Extensively, in fact. I would definitely volunteer my brain for something like this. I'd love to be mapped.
But yeah, if you want to...
A mind map, quite literally.
But if you want to look at any of these brains, you can go, it's called the Knife Edge Scanning Microscope. If you just search for that, there's a brain atlas site, K-E-S-M. And brain atlas.
Or you could go to wired.co.uk and search machine slices brains, and you'll also find quite some interesting visuals as well.
Exactly.
Cool. Well, we're going to slice our way into an ad break. But when we come back, how is French video sharing site Daily Motion planning on getting money to its creators?
Wired magazine, published digitally every month on iPad. Now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Welcome back. Another slightly bad segue there from me into that ad break. But the point was that Daily Motion, which is a French video site, a pretty popular one, I believe, with about 115 million uniques, has an interesting new partnership, Liv.
Yes, it is the second most visited video portal after YouTube, but quite a long way after YouTube. YouTube has 800 million visitors per month. Dailymotion has 115 million. Oh. But it's partnered with Flatter, which is the kind of micropayment system developed by Peter Sund.
Formerly of Pirate Bay fame.
And what it does is it allows people who make videos to put a button in their video that that lets web visitors make little donations to that video.
So how does Flatter work then?
So Flatter works, what you do, you set up an account, you allocate a certain amount each month that you're prepared to donate to content online. And then whenever you see a video or a blog post or a piece of music that you like that has a Flatter button, you can click on it to kind of give it, to flatter it. And then at the end of the month, where it will divide up the amount that you've allocated per month between all the different things that you've flattered. So if you've flattered 100 things, then obviously your £20 per month will be divided 100 ways. But if you've only flattered one thing, obviously all that £20 will go to that one piece of content.
I remember Peter Sunday described this as something like the like button that actually means something.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is.
And so the deal means that everyone who's got content on Daily Motion will now be able to be flattered?
Not everyone who's got content on Dailymotion. Dailymotion has three different types of content. It's got user-generated content, which is mostly, you know, people uploading one-off random videos of their cats, etc. Then they've got proper content partners who, you know, Reuters and Bloomberg and people like that, and that's an ad-funded model, so that's not affected by this. But the type of content creators who are affected are called motion makers, and these are sort of amateur or professional filmmakers who might otherwise be on something like Vimeo, who don't necessarily want to have 30-second pre-roll and post-roll ads on their videos, and they might not even like advertising, and so they might have, you know, they might upload regular videos, and this is just a way of being able to monetize that content without accepting advertising.
So it costs money to be one of these motion makers, does it?
No, it doesn't. It's free to be a motion maker, unlike something like Vimeo, where you pay to host your videos. And actually, so I think this could be something that might lure people who are otherwise using Vimeo to Daily Motion.
I find it quite interesting, though, that YouTube isn't the partner for this. I mean, that could have been absolutely huge.
Well, yeah, and it was interesting. So I spoke to the community manager of Flatter, Seam Teller, and although he wouldn't say anything, he did say we're working up the ladder to some bigger deals. And so he was insinuating that perhaps people like YouTube or other big content partners might be in the pipeline.
Though, of course, Dailymotion doesn't have a competing payment platform of its own, whereas Google very much does.
So, Google Checkout.
Yeah, exactly. So that might be the reason why that hasn't got off the ground yet.
But the thing with Google Checkout, though, is that it's much more like PayPal in that it's connected to a bank account, and you pay a fixed amount of money to somebody for something, whereas this is a lot more, I mean, kind of, as he described, a like button, but it feels much more like, you know, where you have credits on a site and you've already paid for them, and when you spend them, it doesn't really feel like you're spending money. It feels like you're spending credits, even though you paid for them.
And I really like the kind of subscription model of Flatter, so you always know how much you're going to be giving. You're not going to have this horrible bill at the end of the month where you've kind of been accruing all these different micropayments. And I think that's what makes a big difference here.
But I guess it's a lot less predictable for content creators, for artists.
Yes, absolutely. And I think they were saying that, you know, some of their podcasters, which is the only really kind of comparison they could make in terms of the sorts of revenues you could make, do make a full living using Flatter, but it's not that many of them.
I wonder what PayPal must be thinking, because I really think that PayPal has missed the boat here. Because what's so great about Flatter is that, you know, you're logged into Flatter, and when you press the Flatter button, it's just like a like button. It just changes to like. I can't remember the terminology it used. Flattered.
Flatter. Yeah. But then who knows about Flatter? That's the problem.
Well, hopefully, with any luck, the fact that we're talking about it right now will inspire some people to go and check it out and maybe add it to their own sites if they run sites.
Yeah, well, let us know what you think. Have you been flattered? Do you like to flatter? podcast@wired.co.uk. Maybe one day you can flatter us. The Pirate Bay, it has been ruled, must be blocked in the UK. A high court has ruled that broadband customers of Sky, Everything Everywhere, TalkTalk, O2 and Virgin Media must be cut off from the infamous Swedish file-sharing site from this month. And Virgin Media has already imposed the ban, which means if you're a Virgin Media customer, and I think they're the second biggest broadband provider in the UK, they've already cut access off. That means...
Well, sort of.
Well, they've blocked access to the Pirate Bay's main website, which isn't really that big of a problem because torrents, by their very nature, don't have to exist on a single website. And all this has really done is stopping people from accessing the Pirate Bay. It's not stopping them using BitTorrent. It's not stopping them using torrents that were hosted on the Pirate Bay.
And it's not stopping them using a proxy to access the Pirate Bay.
No.
But so hang on, why has this happened? Why has it been blocked by all, it's going to be blocked by all these ISPs?
Well, the reason it's been blocked is because the British phonographic industry has been putting a lot of pressure on the courts to, to get the courts to force the Pirate Bay to be blocked because of its role in piracy and illegal downloading.
Back in February, I think on the podcast then, we discussed this. Justice Arnold, who was on behalf of the High Court, said that the torrent site and its users were committing copyright infringement and the Pirate Bay operators incite or persuade users to commit copyright infringement.
And the problem here, though, is that the Pirate Bay came out in a blog post and actually effectively thanked the BPI for all the extra, quote, free advertising because it caused visitors to the site to surge to an additional 12 million after the news, which, is...
You can't really buy that kind of advertising, really.
You can't. And this is, we could talk about, the pros and cons of these sorts of bans, but it's another example of people doing what they perhaps, their industry requires that they have to do, but in exactly the wrong way. It's just attracting more attention to
it's the Streisand effect, isn't it?
It is. I mean, we saw this in 2008. It was a really good example. The Internet Watch Foundation, which basically is out there to stop child pornography and child sex abuse appearing on the web and block access to it. And they updated their blacklist to include Wikipedia because an album cover by the 70s metal band Scorpions featured a image of a naked child. And it meant that a large portion of the UK, the UK's internet users, couldn't access Wikipedia at all. The news broke. It was global news, for several days. And it meant that visitors to that particular album's page on Wikipedia it just had a huge surge in popularity. I'm pretty sure it was one of the most visited pages on Wikipedia that week. And the Internet Watch Foundation eventually retracted the Wikipedia ban and basically said, yeah, it attracted a lot of people to this that we were trying to block. Again, the Streisand effect.
So we're off topic ever so slightly here, but why is it called the Streisand effect?
It was in the 90s? I forget when exactly it was, but Barbara Streisand had tried to get some images banned effectively and removed
off her house. She didn't want anyone knowing where she lived, so she got a court order to make sure that no one could show these pictures of where she lived, but that picture had to be sent to the court, and therefore loads more people saw it than I think only a handful of people had seen it before, and then hundreds of thousands of people saw it because she had to file it with the courts.
I think we should also talk about the other aspect of this, which is the fact that these kind of blocks just don't work.
They don't work, and particularly with something like BitTorrent, it's designed to be resilient. It's designed in much the same way as the internet itself is designed. It can get around blocks. It can get around, some kind of central system being taken offline because it exists kind of everywhere in lots of bits and pieces.
Mm. Now, it's kind of interesting because the courts have actually used not a DNS level block. DNS level blocks would be, the DNS system is the bit that changes the piratebay.se link to a series of numbers, an IP address that sends you to the site. So if you do a DNS block, it stops you from typing in a name and going to that site. You can still go type in the numbers direct and go to that site, but that's not what's happened here. They've actually blocked the IP address of the site entirely. So you need a proxy to access the site, and several have already sprung up. The UK Pirate Party has already put one up, and you can use kind of like general proxies as well to access the site. It's trivial to do. I did it this morning. I'm on Virgin, and I did it this morning.
Not that we're encouraging people to do that to pirate stuff.
No, and I guess the point is that, it... obviously has been shown that there's lots of people infringing copyright on the Pirate Bay. I know this is, you know, like it or not, it's happening and the court has to act in some way. And currently there aren't, as we've discussed in many other episodes, there aren't any other good kind of viable alternatives being presented by the content creators. And so we're kind of left, the courts are kind of left with no other real measures that are going to be satisfactory to the copyright creators. And so this is, I don't necessarily think it's a good approach, but it's something they have to sort of
do. They do. I mean, they're an industry body. They are acting for their industry's best interest. They're just doing it wrong. Mm. You know, on the start of the show, we're talking about Spotify coming up with, you know, discounts for students and new iPad apps and things like that. And in the second half of the show, we're talking about trying to block a website that doesn't actually even need to exist to, you know, to provide these files.
I mean, the ridiculous thing about all of this is that the music industry, wider than just records, but the music industry as a whole is bigger than it has ever been. More human beings are listening to more music than ever before in the world. Mm. All of the creative industries are growing and are posting, you know, record sales and stuff like that. So it's really curious to see their industry bodies come over and say, yeah, piracy's killing us. Yeah, we're dead. Yeah, nothing much we can do here.
Well, we're definitely preaching to the converted here anyway. We are aware of that. But if you do have a view for or against what's been happening with the Pirate Bay, podcast@wired.co.uk, do let us know. On that note, I think we're going to transition into a slightly more interesting feature, which this week, well, not interesting, lighthearted. It involves
graves,
death, cemeteries, cadavers, corpses. Katie Scott.
Hello.
Is here. I wasn't including you in that list.
I was going to say it's a nice cheery intro.
I'm sorry, yes. Now, there's a reason that we've been talking about graves and the dead and the underworld, because something interesting is going on in a cemetery. Tell me, why is a cemetery interesting this week?
Well, basically, I've been investigating a project called the Future Cemetery Project, which is all about using technology to bring stories about and from cemeteries to life. And specifically, it's one cemetery, the Arnos Vale Cemetery down in Bristol. And I've been talking to some of the guys involved in the project and talking to them about how they're trying to move away from the notion of cemeteries just being for the dead.
But when you say about bringing these stories to life, I mean, are we talking about the cemetery itself, or are we living the tales of the deceased through the eyes of modern media?
Kind of a bit of both. So there's over 300,000 people either buried or have been cremated at the cemetery.
Okay.
And so there's all of these amazing stories. And basically the cemetery is looking for a new way of bringing these stories to life, bringing them to the public. But we're also talking about, you know, the stories told by people who work at the cemetery, who've lived at the cemetery. And it's all with the end game of trying to make cemeteries into something other than, you know, creepy places where you sort of wander gingerly around graves. But John Troyer from the University of Bath Centre for Death and Society can explain it far better.
The premise is heritage is as much about the future as it is about the past. And what we were interested in was taking both the Victorian past of Arnos Vale Cemetery. It's been there for just about 170 years. There's 320,000 bodies, or 320,000 bodies, pardon me, have gone through Arnos Vale, either in terms of burial or cremation at the site. And there's a lot of stories to be told. So we wanted to build a project that weaved together that sort of Victorian past, all those stories buried in the ground, with a kind of digital present to produce, in effect, a digital user space or something that people could use today at a cemetery.
The team has started by gathering stories from the cemetery. Felicia Smith from Arnos Vale explains that these include everything from stories about grave robbers, accounts of the horrors of a cholera outbreak in the city, to details about what she calls time-travelling graves, or people buried in the cemetery who have been moved there from elsewhere, but actually died before Arnos Vale was opened. And there are also tales from people who have lived or worked in the cemetery. John adds that some of these stories from ordinary people are the most compelling.
There are a lot of people buried in Arnos Vale. The vast majority of people buried in Arnos Vale are just, if you will, ordinary people who have very, very interesting stories, but stories that we would never really ever hear because they're not regarded as being significant individuals in the way that some historical figures are. And so one of the things that I'm interested in trying to capture is the feel of a person, a person's story who is buried there, lived a great life, did a lot of really interesting things, or actually rather infamous things, and trying to bring some of those stories to the forefront too.
Felicia says that these stories are being handed over to a team of writers with the hope that they can bring them to life and then technology be created to deliver them to the public.
What's unusual about this project for a heritage site is that we're using the facts, the history, the heritage as a starting point, but what we're asking them to do is be creative with it and come up with partly fictionalised accounts that we can then use for visitors to experience the site in a different way. The way that we give those stories at the moment is kind of through straight biographies, through our guided tours and through our material on site and our guidebook. And this is allowing them to play with it a little bit, but while still being kind of stimulated by the original kind of facts, but playing with the narrative a little bit. What we want to do is really leave it open for the writers to come up with some creative ideas from which we'll select a few that we can then provide as the basis for the digital technology we'll be using. But we've decided, we feel it's really, really important that the content drives the React project for us rather than the technology. So the technology is there just to augment what we want to do with the content.
So what about the tech behind this then? Because obviously there's a lot of tech involved.
Well, one of the things that they're talking about is perhaps creating an app so that people can access, you know, the data that they have, but also, you know, the stories as they walk around the cemetery. Mm. One of the things that they're keen to emphasise is whatever technology they use has to be accessible to everyone. And that's one of the things that John talked to me about.
I think it's a good idea, and I think it's important we develop something people can then download onto, say, their phone. But of course, not everybody has a phone that can do that. And increasingly, more and more people do, and we're going to reach a point, a certain threshold, where everybody just has a, you know, integrated device that can handle that. So we're trying to figure out a multitude of ways to get what we produce into people's hands, or so they can hear it, because accessibility is certainly a big issue that way.
The aim of the project is not only to encourage more and diverse people to visit Arnis Vale, but also to create a platform that other cemeteries can adopt. Jeremy from Calling the Shots, the technology partner in this project, says that the ultimate aim is to change the public's attitudes towards cemeteries as just places of the dead.
I hope it contributes to a kind of new to a conversation with a new kind of audience, really. That's the main thing. Can we start to encourage a new, different demographic or different segment of the population to visit cemeteries? Because they need people to come visit them. They need to be sustained financially. I mean, these cemeteries like Arnis Vale, when they were made, they were landscaped in beautiful gardens for people to go and walk. They weren't just places of the dead. So can we get back to that? And what would actually bring people to come back to these cemeteries? You know, what we're doing is experimenting, trying to find some interventions which are interesting enough to make people think, oh, okay, I wouldn't normally go to a cemetery, but this is something that I would go for, to experience this and to explore this.
All sounds very exciting. Hope it goes very well. Could be a grave day for all concerned.
I was waiting for the bad one. For the bad pun, and there we go.
If it doesn't go right. Tell me where I can find out more. I'm interested.
Well, there's more information about the Heritage Sandbox project, which this is one of six projects that's basically got funding. There's more details on the Watershed website, but we've also put together a feature for wired.co.uk about the six projects and what people can expect when they come into being in September.
What do they search for on Wired to find it?
Well, why don't you search for cemetery?
Good idea. Katie Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Right, there we go. Another show is in the bag. Duncan Gear, Olivia Solon. We've done this 74 times. How many more, I wonder?
At least 74.
At least 74. Lots. Quite a lot. But you can get in touch with us for any of our future shows, and Duncan is going to tell you how.
You can phone us on 0208 123 0468 from a landline or a mobile, which is local rate in the UK. Or you can call us on Wired UK Podcast on Skype for free, all across the world. So we want to hear from you, Mr. Person in Argentina.
And you can also get us on Twitter. We're on at Wired UK, and we've got a bloody fantastic Facebook page, facebook.com/WiredUK.
Is it corking?
It is corking. It is spiffing. But there's also an email address you can catch us on, as we mentioned before, podcast@wire.co.uk.
And of course, the new issue of the magazine's out on sale now. It's a June issue. It's on iPads as well. We've gone Retina. Took us not very long to go Retina display, but it is out now. Go and check it out. And of course, we will see you all again next Vocca. Goodbye.
Bye.